Hello with the Cryptic Code. I'm your host, Armin, and we'd like to welcome you to our second annual, kind of, Spooktacular. You see, autumn is a magical time of the year. The nights grow longer, darker. Once green forests become a swaying collage of orange, red, and gold. Kids ride bikes along suburban streets and rural paths laden with fallen leaves, and wait eagerly for the 31st to arrive. Halloween. The night when we cast off our mortal masks and don the faces of monsters, beasts, and specters. Yet this night has more meaning than spooky costumes and free candy. Long ago, when the world was younger, stranger, and far more mysterious, the Celtic people knew this night as Samhain. To them, this day marked the end of the year and a transition from summer to winter, a time when the veil between worlds is thin, when the dead and other things are free to walk the earth. These legends seem silly to us now. We have filled in the corners of our maps, we have climbed the most remote peaks, and we have searched under every bed and every closet with nary a goblin or boogeyman or dragon in sight. We have become convinced that our knowledge of the earth is absolute, and that the myths of the past can rest firmly in their graves. Yet, I think something of the old ways still lingers in our blood. We feel it stir when we see the blackened, barren branches of dead trees, or shudder at the chilly wind whistling through half-cracked windows. Ancient superstitions tickle from the back of our minds as we stare down a dark, lonely road and suspect, even if only for a moment, that we might not know the world as well as we think. But I think we feel it most when we join the time-honored tradition of storytelling. Something about the autumn season conjures up our dark creativity, and we tell tales of ghosts and ghouls and other things that lurk in the shadows. And tonight, I wish to join in that tradition. So, for now, I'll leave behind the skeptical and analytical parts of this podcast and simply tell you a few stories from the dark hills and haunted hollers of my home state, West Virginia. Our first tale tonight shall be an Appalachian classic that I'm sure every West Virginian native listening has heard in school at least once. I actually remember hearing it the first time in elementary school. But for this tale, we start with an old man who lived in a cabin tucked away within the rolling mountains. The old man lived alone. And that was how he liked it. He didn't like people, nor the problems they often brought with them. That's why he moved out here, after all. To get away from people and their noise, their opinions, their attitudes. His cynical nature would lead many to think of the old man as grumpy or mean. A description he himself wouldn't really argue with. No, he spurned the fellowship of man, and so built himself a little cabin with only his three dogs to keep him company. He rarely came to town, and when he did, he offered no more conversation than was needed to buy supplies, sell furs, and be on his way. In truth, he mostly lived off the land, foraging for brush, picking mushrooms, and of course hunting wild game. And yet the winter had been harsh. For days, he had to rely on the canned beans from town to get through the day. And at the end of his first week on a beans-only diet, he decided it would be best to brave the cold and frost to take his chances hunting for fresh meat. So, he gathered up his dogs, loaded up his rifle, and ventured out into the snow. And it was fruitless. The forest was lifeless. With the coming of winter, the squirrels retreated into their trees and bears into their caves. No deer wandered the white-peaked hills, and the sky was free of birds, who had long since ventured south. When the old man saw the sun sinking beyond the horizon, he was still empty-handed. He knew he should have gone home. The woods are no place for an old man at night, and strange things come out after dark. but his stomach grumbled, and he remembered his hunger. With it came determination, and perhaps more than just a little bit of pride. This was his mountain, damn it, and he wasn't going to let the dark and some spooky stories scare him away. Instead, he tightened his grip on his rifle and pressed forward. Bit by bit, the sun sank lower and lower. The thin threads of golden light were severed, one at a time, as the shadows darkened and night fell. It wasn't long until the old man started to have some doubts about his choices to stay out, especially when the dog's ears shot up, alert and listening. A few moments passed and he heard something himself, the soft crunch of paws on snow. He whipped his head around, searching the darkness between the tall trees, but saw nothing. Only blackness answered him. A few fingers of panic were creeping in on him from the fringes of his mind. His heart beat faster, and his hands felt sweaty against the cobalt metal of the gun. What was it? It sounded too big to be a bobcat, but far too small to be a bear. His steps were slow, but rhythmic. Cautious, but deliberate. Whatever it was pacing, stalking. No, this was not wild game. This thing moved like a predator. The old man nearly jumped out of his skin when the dog started barking. Crowding protectively at his feet, the dog stared off into nothingness, and the old man stared with them. Their hair stood up, they flashed their fangs, and howled their challenges out into the night. Yet, even above their cries, a single noise echoed through the still, night-shrouded forest. Laughter. Awful, maniacal laughter that sounded almost human. Who's out there? The old man shouted, trying to hide the tremble in his voice. All he got in response was the crunch of snow. Growing louder, closer. Suddenly his eyes adjusted to a low light, and out from the night a silhouette emerged from the inky tenebris, a shadow blacker than the darkness surrounding it. All he could make out was the general form of the thing, a slender body, a long tail, and a head affixed with big, sharp teeth. And then he saw a flash, just a flash, of something else, of red eyes. The rifle shot cracked like thunder, drowning out the laughter and the barking. It was followed by a peal of hideous screeching, that of a feline, of a madman. The thing hurried away into the cover of night, and the forest again fell silent. The old man investigated the spot. Several paw prints, larger than any mountain lion's, trailed off before disappearing. Whatever beast it was, its stride was huge. A sprinkle of red dotted the white snow. Too little to be a mortal wound, he knew, and the point was proven when he found a long strand of flesh and fur. A tail. Better than nothing, the old man mumbled as he tucked the strange tail into his pocket. Then he marched back home. The tail was meager on meat, but beans made it a full meal. Enough of one to take the sting out of his hunger pains. With a bit of whiskey to warm him, he went to bed. The image of the thing was far from his mind. From the safety and warmth of his cabin, it was easy to dismiss what he had seen. It was probably just a bobcat or something, and the fear of the moment made it seem so much larger. And that laugh, well, it couldn't have been a laugh. He was just mishearing things. After all, the mountains can play tricks on your senses, especially at night. No, there's nothing to be afraid of. All he needed was to lie down and slip into sleep. Then came a sound from the window. Scratching. A scratching of long, sharp claws against wood. And just beneath it, a low, raspy whisper. Daily Bow, give me back my Daily Bow. The old man grumbled. He convinced himself it was no voice he heard, but the whimpers of some animal. He opened the door and ushered his animals out, commanding them to go after the beast. The obedient hounds gave chase and, in seconds, disappeared beyond the tree line. For several moments, he heard only the howls of the dogs and the shrieks of something else. Eventually, the dogs returned. Most of them. Of the three, only two had come back. The old man sat uneasily in his chair, telling himself that the dog was simply lost and would eventually find its way home. Yet, he felt less confident when again he heard the scraping upon the windowsill. And again, that voice, louder than before, called out, "Daily Bow, Daily Bow, give me back my Daily Bow." Again, the old man opened the door and ordered his remaining dogs to chase the creature off. And again, they did so. This time, however, only a single dog returned. The old man sat in his armchair, his hand absentmindedly caressing the barrel of his gun. It brought him some comfort, but not much. Not much when, for the third time that night, he heard the scratching at his window. "Daily Bow, Daily Bow, give me back my Daily Bow." The old man held his gun at the ready as he approached the door, its last loyal hound staying close to his shins. With one on the trigger, the other hand, shaking and trembling, reached for the doorknob. And part of him started to wonder. Wonder about what he would see on the other side. He had glimpsed the thing once. Even then, it was in shadow. Was he truly ready for what he was about to see? With a sudden flash of courage, he opened the door. And nothing greeted him but a stretching blanket of white and a wall of black, dotted with flakes of falling snow. With his eyes to the iron sights, he glanced from side to side. Nothing. He didn't know if he was scared or relieved. Suddenly, the dog bounded out from under him and scampered off into the trees, barking all the while. He wanted to give chase, he wanted to run after it. He didn't want to leave his dog alone, but damn it, he couldn't move. His feet just stayed planted to the spot, too scared to go after him. All he could manage, though he felt no shortage of shame, was to step back inside and close the door. The old man was shaking now, so much so that when he poured himself a drink, more whiskey ended up on the floor than in the glass. And downing it did not seem to steady his nerves that he had hoped. He sank into his armchair and fixed his sights on the door. Only the whistling of the wind could be heard, and it was deafening. So much so that the old man did not hear the squeak of the window opening, nor the gentle patter of paws across the floorboards. In truth, he heard nothing until a voice whispered in his ear. A voice that hit like an explosion. A low, raspy voice. "Now I have my Daily Bow." Chilling, huh? It's a classic for a reason, and a favorite among Appalachians. And a reminder that out in the woods, humanity's spot atop the food chain becomes a lot less certain. Out there, alone, we're reminded that we were once just as much prey as predator. So, if there's anything to take away from this story, it's that sometimes isolation is not escaping our problems, but running headlong into new ones, with no one around to help. For now, though, we'll be trading the comfort of our not-so-safe cabin for the simple shelter of a nylon tent. Our next story comes from an article from WVUExplorer.com titled "True Ghostly Tales Recommended for Your Next West Virginia Campfire." How convenient, since we find ourselves around just such a campfire tonight. The tale is named "The Legend of the Screaming Thing" by one J.B. Workman. This story was told to me by my mother, and was also told to me by my best friend's mother. There are a lot of witnesses to the story, and most of them grew up on Paddle Creek. Some people believe Paddle Creek to be haunted. At night, you could hear screaming in the woods. My mother told me it sounded like a woman screaming and would raise the hair on the back of your neck, so they called it the screaming thing. Some people believed it to be a crazy old lady that lived down the road from my best friend's house. Some believed it to be a big cat at one time. But there's no such cat in these parts. The funny thing is that you could hear it on one side of the woods, and a few seconds later on the other side. There is no old lady or big cat that fast, and some believed it to be a ghost of some kind. Some people would see black figures at the time of the screaming. My mother was coming home from church one night when all at once, a black figure sailed out from a tree, over her head, and went over a hillside. Then the screaming started, and mother hurried home. People tried to chase it down, but every time they would find nothing. Hunters would wait for it, just to come home empty-handed. No one could catch it, and no one knew what it was. For our next story, we're leaving the snow and mountains behind and journeying to Princeton, West Virginia. More specifically, a spot about 5 miles from town. So, fasten your seatbelts, keep your arms inside the ride at all times, and join me for an evening of fun at the old Lake Shawnee Amusement Park. Amusement parks are, at least in theory, places of fun, of laughter and smiles. So doing natural at these places have an air of the uncanny when they go quiet, when the rides are empty and the music has faded. Instead of joy and bright lights, it's cold and quiet. The rustic rides become eerie, uneasy reminders that nothing, no matter how badly we want it to, lasts forever. Lake Shawnee. You likely heard of it before. It's no Trans-Allegheny or Moundsville, but Lake Shawnee has garnered a good deal of infamy online. The image of the Ferris wheel, green with overgrowth, and the swing ride that looks more like a weeping willow or eye-catching, iconic even. It draws one in. Most people know about the deaths that caused it to shut down, yet the history of this place is longer and bloodier than one would imagine. It all started with Mitchell Clay. He was the first settler in Mercer County as he moved his wife and 14 children to an 800-acre property on what is now Lake Shawnee in 1775. Now, I say first settler, but we all know Europeans weren't the first people here. The land was inhabited by the Shawnee tribe, who were not too happy about being forced out of their home. You see, the Clay family were the first Europeans to settle Mercer County, but their plot of land was given to them by a soldier named John Draper. Draper, in turn, was awarded the plot by the royal governor for his service in Lord Dunmore's War, which you may recognize from our Mothman episode. Eventually, as they often sadly do on the frontier, things got violent. One day in 1785, Mitchell left his family to go hunting. In his absence, two of his sons, Bartley and Ezekiel, were to build a fence on a pasture, and several of his daughters were in charge of doing laundry by a river. Suddenly, there was a crack of rifle shots, and Bartley dropped dead. A band of Shawnee swarmed Ezekiel, taking him prisoner. One of the Clay daughters, Tabitha, heard the shot and came running, rushing to Bartley's side, only to get grabbed and stabbed to death. Upon his return, Mitchell found out about the attack and rounded up a number of neighbors to form a posse. They pursued the Shawnee all the way to Chillicothe and killed several along the way. But sadly, it was too late for Ezekiel, who was burned to death at the stake. Mitchell Clay was driven mad by his grief and rage and decided to take drastic action. Supposedly, that same posse and himself were returned to Mercer County and massacred several Shawnee men for revenge. right on the spot where, in 1926, one C.T. Snydro would open his amusement park, Lake Shawnee. The park was wildly successful, for the area at least. A man-made lake for which the park got its name, a pool for swimming, cabins for rent, and a number of attractions brought in hundreds of guests. Yet, no amount of merriment could wash away the past. And in time, the park would suffer from its own fresh tragedies. Supposedly, one of the most notorious instances was to have a little girl who was riding the swing ride while a truck was delivering drinks. When the truck backed up to leave, the driver had unknowingly backed into the path of one of the swings, and the girl died as she collided with the side of the truck. That wouldn't be the only fatality in the park. One boy supposedly drowned in the lake, which is actually off limits for swimming. We don't have concrete dates for those two deaths, but we do know that a second drowning happened in the pool. In 1966, a boy died after getting his arm stuck in a pipe and was unable to get free in time. 1 year later, the park was closed down after a failed health inspection. But the thing about ghost stories is that nothing stays at rest for too long. In 1985, former employee Gaylord White decided to buy, renovate, and reopen the park. And it did so to some success, with thousands coming to breathe life into the place. Yet, it wasn't the last. Lake Shawnee again fell silent a mere 3 years later. It wasn't death that made them shutter their doors, but insurance prices. Unable to afford it, the White family closed the park, but kept the land active with other activities such as fishing tournaments. Among their plans was to clear space for mudbogging, a classic West Virginian pastime where they race cars through muddy courses. During the construction, however, they found something strange. Bones. Lots of bones. They ended up contacting the archaeology department at Marshall University, Gohard, who discovered that the park was built on, I shit you not, a Native American burial ground. They're here. 13 remains were uncovered, but according to the White family, experts estimate a potential 3,000 bodies were buried beneath the soil. Disturbingly, they appeared to be mostly young children and elderly. The Marshall excavation team theorized that it may have been the result of a flu that devastated the tribe. Those who were healthy enough to have a chance had to flee, leaving the vulnerable behind. Might seem heartless, but it appears to be an act of pure desperation. And it might hint that the land surrounding Lake Shawnee might have always been sour. Today, the old park sits dormant, but not lifeless. The White family allows ghost hunts and even hold Halloween festivities there. Its popularity skyrocketed when it was visited by prominent paranormal shows such as Portals of Hell, Ghost Lab, Scariest Places on Earth, and plenty more. Which is why it's no surprise that there's more than a few ghost stories about the place. People will hear dissonant voices crying out, supposedly those of the Shawnee who died there, either from disease or by Mitchell Clay's vengeance. Back in the park's active years, one woman reported a mysterious force trying to drag her under the water as she swam in the same pool where the young boy had died. Most of the activity seems centered around the little girl killed on the swings. People report catching glimpses of her, and the swing of which she is said to have died is known to shake and tremble without reason. People who see her describe her as wearing a pink dress with ruffles on the sleeve. You will even see a tractor parked in place, long abandoned and left to rot. Why? Because while one member of the White family was using it, the girl appeared and asked if she could have it. Be it fear or some sense of compassion for the departed, the White family obliged and has never since moved the tractor from the spot. Much like the rest of Lake Shawnee, it was left to wither, a testament to what once was. For our last story, I wanted to present something a little more old school. a traditional tale shared around campfires in Appalachia for years. Because really, what discussion of West Virginian folklore would be complete without mentioning the works of the impeccable Roof and Music? For those who don't know, Ann Music was a folklorist who spent the bulk of her career studying and teaching folklore at Fairmont University. Go Falcons. And was a founding editor of the West Virginia Folklore Journal, as well as even revitalizing the State Folklore Society. Yet, if you're familiar with her work, it's probably through her books. Green Hills of Magic, Coffin Hollow, and Tonight's Entry. So, take a seat. Pour yourself a hot, possibly pumpkin spice drink, and relax as I read you an assortment of stories from the Telltale Lilac Bush. Draga's Return. There is an old saying in Yugoslavia that if a cat crosses the body of a dead person, the spirit of that person will reappear as a ghost. Such a fantastic thing happened to the body of Draga Vilic. The family had been careful that a cat did not come near the body, but a window was left open near a coffin. A hungry cat jumped to the windowsill and then across the body. The first night after Draga was buried, his spirit returned to haunt his family. His wife was awakened by his cold arms about her and his cold lips kissing her. A strange noise was heard by all, a roaring, rolling noise, so penetrating that the whole house seemed to shake. Draga's wife and the surrounding neighbors were terribly frightened, but it all stopped in the early morning when a cock began to crow. After repeated visits of the ghost, Draga's wife went to the old priest and told him of the strange happening. He told her when the ghost returned to tie some thread from the spool to the spirit as it caressed her. In the morning, they would follow the thread to see where it might lead. The following night, the ghost returned, and Draga's wife followed exactly the instructions of the priest. The next morning, the priest and some men followed the thread to the grave of Draga. The priest told the men to get a long, sharp stake. They ran the stake through the grave and the coffin in the body of Draga. The stake held the spirit down in the ground, and no longer was Draga's wife haunted by it. The Phantom Dog. When I was still in the pen and feather stage of boyhood, there was a story told in the village of Roanoke of a man who rode into the village one day on a beautiful sorrel horse, followed by a shepherd driving dog. He was a cattle buyer looking for cattle, and on the next day went back into the hills to bargain with a family for some cattle. He was never seen or heard of again. A while later, some of the village people, who had grown suspicious of the man's disappearance, came upon the dog near the top of a high point overlooking the village. The dog had worn a path completely around the hill, except at one place where he would jump up on a 6-foot-thick chestnut log and then jumped down again. Many who came to see the dog ring, as it was called in the neighborhood, thought that perhaps the dog's master had been sitting there when he was killed. Someone finally shot the faithful dog, and tying a heavy stone to the body, threw it into the river. But after 9 days, the body was seen floating just beneath the surface. This unusual happening doubled the suspicions of the village. The suspected family were kept under close watch. Men hidden and about the fields where they had worked or followed them about at night, hoping to overhear some word that would solve the mystery. But the word was never spoken. Then, one day, a beautiful young woman rode into Roanoke on a sorrel horse, a dead match for the one ridden by the man who had disappeared. The woman was seeking for news of her husband. When she heard about the man, the horse, and the dog, she was sure that this had been her husband, and she turned around and went sadly to her home near Jonestown. The people of the vicinity were more suspicious than ever, and continued spying on the suspected family, but they could still discover nothing. Soon, though, this family seemed to have acquired some wealth. They bought more land, more cattle, more of everything. The village people would have nothing to do with them. Finally, one of the men began to break under the strain. He drank heavily, and when he was drunk, he would see a shepherd driving dog. He would throw stones at it, and would curse and cry, but the dog remained to plague him. Strange to say, no one else was ever able to see the dog. The man sold out and moved to a distant part of the region, but the dog followed. Finally, he sold all of his holdings and moved to the far west. Whether the dog followed him there, we never knew. The Telltale Lilac Bush. An old man and woman once lived by themselves along the Tigard Valley River. There had been trouble between them for many years. Few people visited them, and it was not immediately noticed that the wife had unaccountably disappeared. People suspected that the old man had killed her, but her body could not be found, and the question was dropped. The old man lived a gay life after his wife's disappearance, until one night when a group of young men were sitting on his porch, talking of all the parties which the old man was giving. While they were talking, a large lilac bush growing nearby began to beat on the window pane and beckoning towards them as though it was trying to tell them something. No one would have thought anything of this if the wind had been howling. But there was no wind, not even a small breeze. Paying no attention to the old man's protests, the young men dug up the lilac bush. They were stunned when the roots were found to be growing from the palm of a woman's hand. The old man screamed and ran down the hill towards the river, never to be seen again. Oh, did you hear that? I think there's someone at the door. Trick-or-treaters, I suspect. And it's about that time. So, this will end our stories for now, and I hope you enjoyed. After all, there are pumpkins to be carved, candy to be handed out, and a long night of frights and delights ahead. Be sure to enjoy it. Halloween only comes once a year. So, good night. And we here at the Cryptic Code wish you a very, very happy Halloween.